Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Another week, another round of fighting over pandemic policies. In Union County, that fighting leads to legal threats from North Carolina's Secretary of Health and Human Services. In Charlotte, the school board extended mask mandates in schools. And Mecklenburg County confirmed it will suspend as many as 600 employees for disobeying COVID testing and vaccine rules. In non-COVID news, a new report reveals fraud concerns at the state housing program. And here we go again with another round of redistricting, starting with city council. Joining me this week to discuss those stories and more are Nick Oxner from WBTV. Good morning.
Hello.
He's fresh off a speaking appearance.
And in a tie.
And a tie. But he needs a haircut. But I digress. Also with us, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News. Jonathan, how are you?
Good morning. Thanks, Eric. Good to see you.
Good morning. Also with us is WCNC's Hunter Sines. Good morning, Hunter.
Howdy, Eric.
And last but not least, WFAE's Claire Donnelly. Good morning to you, Claire.
Good morning.
All right. So let's start with several stories involving area school districts and COVID. On Tuesday, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board voted to extend the district's mask mandate for students and staff. CMS and all districts, according to state law, must vote at least monthly on their mask policies. Jonathan, how much of a policy debate was there about this decision?
Well, before you could even get to that discussion, there were a ton of people that spoke. I think the public input session went for at least 2.5 hours. Now, a number of the people that were speaking were addressing the board about CRT, critical race theory, but also the other half of the comments dealt with people on one side or another of a mask mandate. But once the actual school board got to the discussion, there were several school board members, namely Sean Strain, Rhonda Cheek, and then school board member Saunders, who brought up a little bit of concern with this mask mandate, because it also includes, it kind of dovetailed into the conversation of whether the superintendent has the authority to close schools if there's some sort of outbreak, and whether he needed to first inform. It was a little unclear if they were saying he needed to ask permission of the school board members, but they at least were saying that he absolutely needs to contact them first, and then it is put out to the public. So, they ended up voting for that mandate. I know that Sean Strain did not vote for it, and I believe Rhonda Cheek did not either. But nevertheless, there will be a mandate that goes into effect for CMS employees.
Claire?
I was going to say, I think, this was largely expected that they would extend it. But now what is sort of on the minds of some school board members is, how long do we keep this mandate in place? So what are the metrics? What are the numbers that we're going to be looking at to decide we can drop the mask mandate now, we can drop the quarantine rules now? Which is interesting, given that it sounds like a vaccine could be authorized for children 5 to 12 or 5 to 11 next month. And it sounds like they're going to bring that up at the next CMS board meeting, what exactly those metrics need to be.
Now, also this week, school boards in Lincoln and Union counties scrapped contact tracing, quarantines, and masks. In the case of Union County, they had already done away with masks, but in Lincoln County, masks will no longer be required in schools after September 29th. And in a meeting, I think that Claire, you covered, that lasted all of 15 minutes on Monday morning, Union County School Board voted 8-1 to abandon contact tracing and quarantines. Here is school board member Gary Sides.
It is clear that Union County Public School staff does not have the authority to issue quarantine.
And this is Dramatic Chambers, who has 3 children in the county school system.
The fact that you would take away quarantine and contact tracing to me says that you don't care about our kids at all. Because why wouldn't you want to know who's in the building, who has COVID, and how they are transferring it to other kids? Why would you not want to know that?
So, Claire, other than that comment we just heard, that last soundbite, it doesn't seem like there was a whole lot of debate about this.
Yeah, not among the school board. It sounds to me, I mean, it is important to distinguish that they are basically saying any contact tracing and quarantine guidance has to come from the county health department. They no longer want Union County Public Schools staff involved in that process. And I was talking to a spokesperson for Union County, and they were saying, certainly the public health department is still doing contact tracing and issuing quarantine. It just sort of throws a wrench into the process. And as you heard there, there are a lot of really concerned parents. And another thing I heard from a parent was, the school staff are in the school every day, so they know if someone tests positive, who they would, it would be the most appropriate to issue the quarantine orders to, as opposed to the public health department, which will sort of have to ramp up that process. So it just removes half of that equation to have the Union County staff no longer helping with that, Union County school staff.
I want to read the statement. North Carolina Association of Educators responded to this decision. They said, quote, the Union County Board of Education's decision to allow students to attend school without masks, to end contact tracing, and to end most quarantine procedures is startling and deeply concerning. It's reckless and flies in the face of Union County's own health department, the state, and federal public health officials, end quote. But that, of course, is nowhere near the end of the story. Hunter, by Wednesday, state officials led by Dr. Mandy Cohen were demanding that the school board reverse its decision. What is she telling them, and how long do they have to figure this out?
Yeah, so she basically said that because of this decision, there is this imminent health hazard that Union County and other schools that have done the same, you could factor in Lincoln County schools too, although it's not clear if this paperwork that she sent to Union County goes for Lincoln County as well, since they had made the decision so late in the game. But she's basically saying that there is such an imminent health hazard to students because of this and staff that they need to rescind this decision, basically revisit it and reverse it, or else they will basically see them in the courthouse.
Nick, I'm curious from a state perspective, since you follow the legislature closely, I mentioned that law that they have to, that all the school districts have to make this decision on a monthly basis. Given what we're seeing and hearing, is there any chance that any of that changes at the state level?
You know, it certainly could, but you know, the decision on the monthly basis relates to masking. And that I think was an effort by lawmakers, not to say don't mask, but to say, why don't you rethink this once a month, which is a less of a step than what we've seen Republican legislatures and other states around the country do. But when we're talking about quarantine and contact tracing, I would be shocked if lawmakers want to weigh into that. I do think that we've maybe forgotten a little bit the powers that the State Department of Health and Human Services has in managing the pandemic. We're still under emergency orders from the declaration from the governor. And so they have quite a bit of power to enforce public health directives. And I think we're about to see that play out, or maybe we'll learn they don't if they go to court and lose. But I think we're about to watch that play out one way or another in this legal action that I think is all but assured to come after 5 o'clock today.
Claire?
I did just want to say that we should say it's not that Union County is getting rid of all quarantines. They're still saying you should quarantine if you are symptomatic or test positive. So if you have a positive COVID test, Union County Board of Education does not want you going to school. Please.
They've had a number of cases in the schools already.
Yes, they have. And as of last week, we'll get updated numbers today, but as of last week, there were some 7,000, more than 7,000 students quarantined. So that's part of this is, you know, a small fraction of that 7,000 were those that had tested positive. The issue is just this, you know, 7 to 14 day quarantine period is what we've been hearing from public health officials, because COVID doesn't necessarily, you know, emerge the day after you come into contact with someone who's tested positive.
Now, Nick, I want to ask you, I want to clarify, I'm going to ask a dumb question because that's what I do. The reason that we even have this mask conversation going on is because the governor let that order lapse at the end of July, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so could he just bring that back?
He could if he wanted to. It's pretty clear he doesn't want to, yeah. And it's not going to happen. And so what that result is, you know, these ad hoc mask mandates in different places all across the state.
Got it. Much more to discuss on this and other COVID news, this time with Mecklenburg County workers. Stay with us. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation on the local news roundup with Jonathan Lowe of Spectrum News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Claire Donnelly of WFAE and WCNC's Hunter Signs. And Hunter, let's start with you. You had some updated numbers on the possible suspensions at Mecklenburg County.
Yeah, so remember, these are the number of people who are suspended because they either did not turn in their proof of vaccine and they did not turn in a negative COVID test the first week that they were supposed to. And so, yeah, I'm actually just going over the numbers and it looks like there's now 477 total employees who are still suspended. That's down from 598 earlier this week. Of that, it's important to note there are 198 full-time employees. So a majority of these are part-time employees. I think the biggest number here of the full-time, it's also important that DSS has the highest number with 78 employees. Now, commissioners have reassured that they should be able to handle the workload without 78 people. I personally believe that's a little bit hard to grasp, as we know that DSS and specific cases that they're on have been backlogged because of the pandemic. But at least to Claire's point over the break, people are getting those negative COVID tests turned in.
And continuing this theme, we also had discussion this week when the school board heard a presentation on vaccine and testing requirements for the district's 19,000 employees. Here's how one CMS staff member responded to that.
I urge everyone to stand up and fight back. CMS has no right to force any individual to do anything that goes against the best interest of their own medical health.
So, Jonathan, what is the process that we just heard that staff are criticizing, and how will it work, and how soon will it work, if I can just stack question upon question?
All right, I'm about to sneeze. Can Hunter take this?
Hunter, we're having a bless you moment for Jonathan.
Can you restate that question, Eric?
Yeah, so I was just asking the process that CMS has put in place. How soon will it begin? How will it work?
Oh, yes, for the COVID testing. So yes. It's going to be a phased-in approach. So October 4th, I guess I should start with CMS staff has until September 20th to get in proof of vaccination. Then starting October 4th, they will take half of the elementary schools in CMS, and any staff members who are not vaccinated, ideally, or who haven't shown proof of it, will have to be given or turn in a negative COVID test. So that starts October 4th with half of elementary schools. Then October 11th, we'll go to middle schools. And then by the end of the month, I believe it's October 25th, high schools will be included. So it's a rolling type of phased in approach. But remember, they didn't know who their testing vendor was until the school year had already started. And that's from the state.
And when we're talking about both the Mecklenburg County employees and CMS employees, one of the problems that they're having is testing, just access to testing. It's taking a long time to get the test, correct?
Yeah, so it's taking a little bit of time. You have to remember, testing was really available, and Claire can probably speak better on this, for a while here. And then you start getting school districts who are requiring a negative test and employers who are requiring a negative test. And then you have the federal government coming in and kind of mandating the same thing for businesses over a certain amount of employees. And you're going to start getting backlogs, because then everybody who is not vaccinated already is needing a COVID test. Claire?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it's interesting to see the different approaches. So, you know, some coverage of the CMS announcement was saying that it's mandating vaccines for employees. I'm not sure that that's exactly accurate, because it is essentially saying we are checking your vaccination status, and if you are not vaccinated, we're requiring you to test regularly, which is different than what like the hospital systems are saying, which is you have to get vaccinated and you have to show us proof that you're vaccinated or get a medical or religious exemption. The hospital systems are leaving a lot less wiggle room with that negative test sort of caveat. And like Hunter was saying, it'll be interesting to see going forward how the infrastructure of the testing meets this increased demand for it, unless more places start saying you have to get vaccinated or have a medical or approved medical or religious exemption.
Now, let me, I'm going back and forth here because we have the CMS employees and then we have the Mecklenburg County employees. I think on the Mecklenburg County side, the way this works is that for the public health department of Mecklenburg County, it's like the hospitals where essentially you have to get the vaccine.
Yes.
But then for the rest of the employees, you either have to get the vaccine or have a weekly test. Correct.
Right. So more hoop. Right. So the idea, I think, is more hoops to jump through if you're not vaccinated. And as we've seen in Mecklenburg County, accepting the public health department is suspensions if you don't have that negative test turned in on time. So maybe we'll also see this motivate some county employees to get vaccinated to avoid having to jump through that hoop of taking that test.
Now, Jonathan, I'm not trying to make you sneeze, but I do want to ask you this, which is
Sorry about that.
I think with the county employees, the way this works is that if you miss a week, you're suspended for a week without pay. If you miss 2 weeks, you're fired.
Correct.
Do we know what the consequences are for CMS employees? Are they the same?
You know, that good question. And that was not really addressed at the school board meeting, unless Hunter knows something.
So at the end, the chief human resources officer for CMS basically was telling board members that it can be a fireable offense. If you continue, I mean, she used the words to Claire's is correct in differentiating between hospital and CMS, that it's not as much of a mandate as some of the hospital systems are putting in place, but she used the word mandate. She was like, listen, this is a mandate here that if you're not going to abide by our rules of showing proof or getting a negative COVID test, then it can be a reason for termination. So it's not like the county, which Jonathan is saying, you know, if you miss two, or it's been reported that if you miss four throughout the whole process, there isn't like a limit that has been set yet. But she has alluded that you can be fired as a teacher if you just don't go along with this.
Now, what about, you know, with the school districts? Obviously, we just spent the first segment talking about the differences in terms of students and staff with masks and contact tracing and quarantining. Are they diverging also in terms of vaccine requirements or testing requirements for their employees?
Oh, I haven't actually heard much about that yet. We have, Nick, you were gonna say something?
Well, it's interesting. School systems are often in many counties across the state, some of the largest employers, and in some cases, the largest employer in a lot of counties. But we've not, I think, as the point Claire was about to make, we've not seen many of them mandate vaccines yet. Of course, they don't fall under the mandate that's been announced, but not yet really implemented by the Biden administration because they're public employers, not private employers. And so this is, I actually think CMS is kind of in the early group to tackle employee vaccinations. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with other districts across the state.
Because that Biden 100 employees or greater rule is actually going, it falls under the purview of OSHA, is my understanding.
Right. Not the Department of Education. So there's
right.
There's some differences because of that, correct? In terms of interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. So some districts would count as would fall under OSHA and some districts wouldn't, is my understanding.
Switching topics, one of the blessings of living in North Carolina is that even though redistricting is a once a decade event throughout our nation, here in North Carolina, we never stop talking about it or suing over it or threatening to sue over it. So with that optimism in mind, as an introduction, on Monday, City Councilman Malcolm Graham spoke to reporters about redistricting for upcoming council races. Democrats have held 9 of 11 council seats for the past decade. Jonathan, you were covering this. Do we expect any shift after redistricting?
I think the only two districts that they are looking at possibly something, well, District 7, which is a Republican district, nothing's going to change with that. The one that Malcolm Graham has said could potentially be a toss-up is District 6, but they're waiting on final census data before they start drawing, you know, drawing the maps, and we know truly what the populations of each district is and are. You know, we won't know that part of it, but every other district across the city is unbalanced. So when you ask, could we see any changes or shifts? We probably could see some shifts in as far as population from one district to another. I know that they have suggested District 2 is unbalancing, can shift some, District 1. So shifts politically, probably won't see much of a change, but we'll see districts kind of contract and release as far as the population they have after this whole process is done.
And the one most likely to change in terms of composition is District 6, which is Tark Bakari's district. He's a Republican councilman. And as Steve Harrison from WFAE reminded us this week, Malcolm Graham and Tark Bakari are not the best of friends. So
no love lost between those two.
Right. So, and now Councilman Graham has said that will not factor into what happens, correct? That's what he's saying?
Yeah. So, he was asked about that on Monday, he being Councilman Graham, who's the chair of that ad hoc redistricting committee, whether partisanship was going to be one of the criteria that they're going to look at. And he assured everyone that that it will not be a factor. They're just looking at, which is kind of confusing when you look at what they're actually, the criteria, voter participation, gosh, I have to go find my notes, but there are several, gender, sex, gender is not a criteria. Age will not be a criteria. He did say that race may play a role, but it won't be the dominant factor.
Got it. Now, we know this is really just the undercard because the General Assembly is in charge of carving up the districts, the revamped districts for the North Carolina House and Senate, as well as what will now be 14 instead of 13 congressional districts. I think Nick is already smiling and laughing at the thought of these conversations returning again. They're doing a series of hearings, the House and Senate redistricting committees. They'll be at Central Piedmont Community College here in Charlotte next Wednesday. What are people likely to hear at one of these sessions, Nick?
I mean, this is a really, really tense and partisan thing, right? You've got Democrats who basically we know and liberal groups that are going to say these districts aren't fair because they're drawn by a General Assembly that's controlled by the Republicans. You've got Republicans that see any new map drawing as an opportunity to try to draw maps that are perfectly legal, but give them the best advantage that they can get. And that's why, you know, as Eric alluded to earlier, we go back to court over and over again, because when Democrats ran the General Assembly, Republicans sued them because they drew maps that were more favorable to Democrats. And so that's the framework that we step into, reminder that we had to redraw dozens of state House and Senate districts, what, 4 years ago, maybe, because of a court case. We had two districts had to be redrawn congressional districts, and add into that the fact that we're picking up a congressional seat and there's speculation about where that might go. And so there's a lot to pay attention to and a lot that's on the line.
And Nick, I'm trying to remember, it seems like obviously there have been a lot of these redistricting discussions and decisions, but it seemed to me that I remember in the last few years, there was a more transparent version of this that seemed somewhat more effective. Am I being overly optimistic about that, or is there cause for perhaps hope that they could do this a little more peacefully?
Well, at the end of the day, unless you had a fully bipartisan redistricting commission, which probably isn't going to happen, certainly not going to happen this year, and probably not anytime soon, you're going to have partisans calling it partisan, you know, for their advantage and to challenge that. But yes, what you're talking about is the process where they randomly pulled things out of the lottery machine to help them. But here's actually another interesting point, though, is when we talk about drawing, especially congressional districts, but even state house districts, there's really actually some certain criteria that makes it a lot harder to just full sail gerrymander than you might think in terms of county groupings and stuff like that.
Jonathan, real quick before we go to break.
I'll just add really quickly to dovetail off of what Nick was just saying there. On the city level, Councilman Picari and even Councilman Braxton Winston have suggested maybe in redrawing these districts, adding an eighth district to make things a little bit more fair, in their words. Ultimately, though, Councilman Eggleston told me he you know, it's maybe a little bit too late in the game to try and do something like that.
I can make one guarantee. We are not done discussing this topic, but we are done with this segment. We need to take a break. We'll be right back with more of the Friday Local News Roundup. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing the local news roundup with our panel, WBTV's Nick Oxner, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Claire Donnelly of WFAE, and Hunter Sines from WCNC. This week brought more grief and fear stemming from a series of shootings that police say are connected to students at three high schools. Funeral services were held Wednesday for three-year-old Isaiah Figueroa, who was killed when 150 shots were fired into the toddler's home last week. At the same time, parents and students at North Mecklenburg, Hopewell, and Chambers High Schools continue to worry about rumors of more violence. Local activism photographer Alvin Jacobs, whose son Alvin Jr. is a student at North Meck, had this to say after waking up to texts from his son about fears of a school shooting.
You want to keep your child as calm as possible. You don't want to get all excited because what can they do? Where can they go, right? They can't even leave the classroom. So you're just like, okay, you know, I'll just, you know, be on my way there. You know, real calm, but you're not calm. You're not calm.
Alvin Jacobs will be on this program Monday. Jonathan, this week, two people have been charged in connection with the shooting. What else are police telling us about this?
So those two suspects, it's interesting because of the connection that police and investigators have said is there is to high school students being involved in that shooting. Both of those suspects are 21 years old, one Quintonio Stevens and the other guy that was arrested, Jacob Lanier. It's important to point out Quintonio Stevens is charged with conspiracy, basically helping after the fact. So he's not directly, as far as investigators have said, directly connected to the shooting. Jacob Lanier, however, is being charged with, or is facing charges connected to the shooting. But those are the only two arrests that we have seen so far. We don't really know from investigators if they have any other people of interest, but they at least have said that the other people involved were high school students. So suffice it to say that both CMS law enforcement and CMPD have been keeping a close eye on those three schools that you mentioned.
Claire?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you were about to say something. And Jonathan, in terms of the three high schools, there was the day last week where the threats and the rumors were everywhere and a lot of students didn't go to school. Have we heard anything since? Has it been quiet since then, or?
I think for the most part, it's kind of quieted down. Remember, this kind of all started about a week ago, actually more than a week ago, when there was the shooting, the murder of the 16-year-old in that apartment complex. Remember, the suspect in that was 14 years old, but they believe that that is connected to this, you know, barrage of gunfire, 150 shots at that home. So this happened about a week ago. Ever since then, it's kind of quieted down. We do know that, you know, they, CMS, law enforcement, and CMPD put out some specific rules because we did have a round of Friday football. And so in addition to more officers being present at those schools, they were also keeping a close eye on the games, and we didn't really hear much out of those football games. I think things have quieted down. You know, at this point, we're just waiting to see if there are any additional arrests.
Nick, you've been reporting on a state program to help people pay overdue rent that's funded by federal COVID recovery money. What you've learned and what state officials acknowledge is that checks have been issued to people who aren't landlords and property owners, and landlords and property owners are the people who are supposed to receive these payments directly on behalf of the tenants. Here's what State Treasurer Dale Falwell told you.
It's very disturbing as we started getting more and more of these calls because of the importance of this program.
And this is part of Nick's interview with Laura Hogshead. She is the director of the state office that runs the rent relief program.
But if someone is going to lie, there is not a lot that we can do to stop someone from lying until we find out that they have, and then we can prosecute.
Are you pulling the property record, though, to make sure the person getting the check for this property owns the property?
When a red flag goes up, we do check that. We are not able to check all of the applications. We have 102,000 eligible applicants as of today, and there is no central repository for checking those things.
So, Nick, what's the scope of this problem before we get into how the state may or may not be handling it? What's the scope of the problem?
Yeah, we're talking about at least six figures, several hundreds of thousands of dollars, and potentially millions of dollars in fraudulent checks that have been written in just the sample of checks that we had, which is about 30 or so checks that we had access to, totaled about $260,000 in fraudulent checks being written. So, and the treasurer's office has been made aware of about 400 checks. So we're talking about millions of dollars from this federal program, from the state program, federal dollars.
And how are they, how did they figure out, or whoever figured this out, how did they figure it out? How was it flagged?
Yeah, this was flagged because people, check cashing companies, credit unions, and banks started calling the state treasurer's office, because that's who ultimately writes checks for North Carolina and controls that. And so the treasurer says that his office started getting flooded with calls from check cashing places, credit unions, and banks all across the country that said, hey, look, we have this check. It claims to be a North Carolina check for this housing program, but we think it's suspicious. In the documents that we got from a public records request from the treasurer's office, they talk about in one email from the treasurer's staff to the staff of the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency, NCOR, which is the agency that administers the HOPE program. They said, hey, we got a call from a check cashing place in Georgia. They were suspicious at this check because it's on a North Carolina check, but it's for an address that's not in North Carolina. I mean, hello. in another case, so there are a couple parts of that. One, how did these checks get written? And then two, these records that we got from the treasurer's office shows that even after NCOR and the treasurer's office identified fraud, potentially fraudulent, or determined that checks were being written inappropriately, the NCOR has to go in and issue a stop payment on the check to, so that the treasurer's office can stop the check. But NCOR failed to do that in at least one occasion that we know about.
And I guess this is not the most helpful thing for me to ask you your own question, but I mean, I don't understand how the property check seems like the most basic, rudimentary, fundamental thing you would do when you're trying to deal with rent relief, correct?
That is what I would think. If you have someone who says, I own this property, please pay me the back due rent, you would think, oh, let's check the tax records or the GIS records, both of which you can do in a Google search and take about 3 minutes, if that. I mean, that's what we did with the checks that we got, the sample that we got. I went through the tax records. And Laura Hogshead, who you heard, the director of NCOR, her point in that clip that you just heard is there's not one statewide centralized database with that data, so you'd have to look at each county. I mean, okay, it seems like you could have done that if you wanted to. Or you,
I mean, Nick, it seems like you could have a group of interns do that.
I don't mean to make light of this, but I think this
I don't either. But I mean,
I totally agree with you that it's the very basic thing in my mind. And so the next questions, we're still investigating. The next questions I have is Laura Hogshead said they have an outside vendor that they pay, who knows how much money, to detect against fraud. It clearly didn't stop the checks like the ones that were cashed in Georgia. It didn't, you know, lead to her office putting stop payment on checks, even on fraudsters, even after they knew they had them, like they shouldn't have. So the state is paying, I don't know how much money yet, but taxpayers are paying an outside company to stop these problems. And I'm not clear how effective that is.
One last thing on this. We played that clip from the state treasurer. In light of the reporting and this being more of a public issue now, do you expect anyone in state government to seek any greater oversight or more answers on this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. It's possible that this is something the state auditor, Beth Wood, might look into. It's possible that this is something members of the General Assembly, because you know the HOPE program is already under scrutiny by the legislature. The state Senate passed a bill last week that would change some requirements and regulations related to the HOPE program. That's this program to pay people's past due rent. And so I would suspect that this has the attention of the General Assembly. Wouldn't be shocked if we get an audit out of this of some sort. So we'll see.
Speaking of having people's attention, few stories in the news can match the drama and curiosity factor of the Murdoch family from Hampton County, South Carolina. This is the story. It involves an attempted assisted suicide for hire, a powerful lawyer ousted by his own firm, opioid addiction, unsolved murders, and a Charlotte podcast on these events that is making national news now on its own. Matt Harris of the Matt and Ramona Show was on Chris Cuomo's CNN program this week, and here is how he described his podcast to WCCB's Morgan Fogarty.
It is like Dukes of Hazzard and Dallas and Succession and Ozark and all these shows put together. I think that's the intrigue, this rich, wealthy family of privilege. And although everything is coming tumbling down around them, we have had people tell us we should be quiet. We should. When we first started, they said, don't do it. It's not worth it. People that live down that area, people who are pretty influential in that area. And we know from someone close to the family that they are listening. At least some of the members of the family are listening to the podcast.
I'm not making light of this story, but one of the things that strikes me this morning, I read about HBO is already working on their documentary series about this. There's another podcast, at least one other podcast. You know, we used to give it, I don't know, 6 months, 6 years, something after a big story before we started the reflection and the deeper dive. And now it's almost concurrent. I mean, I'm trying to think of a story that's been like this one in a while. Nick, go ahead.
Well, let's keep in mind, though, this has actually been slowly playing out for several months already. Mm-hmm. It's gotten crazier, of course, since Alec Murdoch tried to have himself killed, I guess is the right way to put that. But, you know, there's been some national attention on this for quite some time, albeit much less. And then obviously until the latest developments when it's really now exploded. But this really isn't that new, even though it might seem that way.
I think what has just drawn people in with this story is the fact that every time there's another layer that's peeled back, it's even bigger, and it kind of blows your mind even more. But if you just start researching this and listening to the podcast and reading up on it, you just learn how this has so many tentacles. And you know, now we're at a level where they're looking into past deaths of so many people, not just the Alec Murdoch's housekeeper, but other people that have died that were connected to this family in some way, inferring that because you know, Alec Murdoch's father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all prosecutors in that county and were heavily connected in the Solicitor General's office down there. And so it's just inferring that there was not just this multiple, murder of his wife and his kids, but the fact he tried to have himself killed and the insurance fraud and being fired from his own family's law firm. I mean, there's just so many other levels to this. It's so intriguing and fascinating.
My conclusion is that John Grisham has been too subtle in his novels, but we will have to leave it there. I want to thank our panel today, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Nick Oxner of WBTV, Claire Donnelly from WFAE, and Hunter Sines from WCNC. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.